of two large walnut trees. At the sight of Lotta he seemed to gain new life, rose, forgot his stick, and ventured to walk towards her. She ran to him and made him sit down again. Then, placing herself by his side, she gave him a number of messages from her father, and then caught up his youngest child, a dirty, ugly little thing, the joy of his old age, and kissed it. I wish you could have witnessed her attention to this old man, how she raised her voice on account of his deafness, how she told him of healthy young people who had been carried off when it was least expected, praised the excellent waters at Karlsbad, and commended his determination to spend next summer there, and assured him that he looked better and stronger than he did when she saw him last. I, in the meantime, paid attention to his good lady. The old man seemed in fine spirits, and as I could not help admiring the beauty of the walnut trees, which form such an agreeable shade over our heads, he began, though with some little difficulty, to tell us their history.
"As to the oldest," he said, "we do not know who planted it. Some say one pastor and some another, but the younger one, there behind us, is exactly the age of my wife, 50 years old next October. Her father planted it in the morning, and in the evening she came into the world. My wife's father was my predecessor here, and I cannot tell you how fond he was of that tree. And it is fully as dear to me. Under the shade of that very tree, upon a log of wood, my wife was sat knitting when I, a poor student, came here for the first time 27 years ago."
Lotta asked after his daughter. He said she was gone with Herr Schmidt to the meadows, to the workers. The old man then resumed his story, and told us how his predecessor had taken a liking to him, as had his daughter likewise, and how he had become first his curate, and subsequently his successor. He had scarcely finished his story when his daughter returned through the garden, accompanied by the above-mentioned Herr Schmidt. She welcomed Lotta warmly, and I confess I was much taken with her appearance. She was a lively and well-formed brunette, with whom it would be quite possible to while away a short time in the country. Her admirer, for such Herr Schmidt evidently appeared to be, was a polite and reserved man and would not join our conversation, despite all Lotta's endeavours to draw him out. I was much annoyed to observe, from his countenance, that his silence did not arise from a want of intellect, but from stubbornness and ill-humour. Alas, this subsequently became very evident when we set out to take a walk, and Friederike, joining Lotta, with whom I was talking, the worthy gentleman's face, which was naturally rather sombre, became so dark and angry that Lotta was obliged to touch my arm and remind me that I was paying too much attention to Friederike. Nothing distresses me more than to see people torment each other, particularly when in the full bloom of life, in the very season of pleasure, they waste their few short days of sunshine in quarrels and disputes, and only perceive their error when it is too late to repair it. This thought dwelt upon my mind, and in the evening, when we returned to the pastor's and were sitting round the table eating curds, the conversation turned to the joys and sorrows of the world. I could not resist the temptation to inveigh bitterly against ill humour. "We are apt," I said, "to complain, but with very little cause, that our good days are few and our bad days many. If our hearts were always disposed to receive the benefits heaven sends us, we should acquire strength to bear the ills when they come." "But," observed the pastor's wife, "we cannot always command our mood, so much depends upon the constitution. When the body suffers, the mind is ill at ease." "I acknowledge that," I continued, "but we must consider such a disposition to be a type of sickness, and ask whether there is no remedy for it."
"I should be glad to hear one," said Lotta.
"At least I think very much depends upon ourselves. I know it is so with me. When anything annoys me and threatens my mood, I hasten into the garden, hum a couple of country dances, and all's well again." "That is what I meant," I replied. "Ill humour resembles sloth. It is natural to us. But if we summon up the courage to exert ourselves, we find our tasks become easy, and we experience in the activity from which we shrank a real enjoyment." Friederike listened very attentively, and the young man objected that we were not masters of ourselves, and still less so of our feelings. The question is about a disagreeable feeling, I added, from which everyone would willingly escape, but none know their own power until they have put it to the test. The sick are glad to consult doctors and submit to the strictest regimes, the bitterest medicines, in order to recover their health. I observed that the good old man inclined his head and exerted himself to hear our discussion, so I raised my voice and addressed myself directly to him. "We preach against a great many vices," I said, "but I never remember a sermon delivered against ill-humour."
"That may do very well for your town clergy," he said. "Country people are never ill-humoured, though. Indeed, it might prove useful, occasionally, for my wife, for instance, and for the land steward."
We all laughed, as did he likewise very heartily, till he fell into a fit of coughing which interrupted our conversation for a time. Herr Schmidt resumed the subject. "You call ill-humour a vice," he remarked, "but I think you use too strong a term." "Not at all," I replied, "if a thing that harms our neighbours and ourselves deserves that name. Is it not enough that we want the power to make one another happy? Must we deprive each other of the pleasure which we can all make for ourselves? Show me the man who has the courage to hide his ill-humour, who bears the whole burden himself without disturbing the peace of those around him. No, ill-humour arises from an inward consciousness of our own want of merit, from a discontent which ever accompanies that envy which foolish vanity engenders. We see people happy whom we have not made so and cannot endure the sight." Lotta looked at me with a smile. She observed the emotion with which I spoke, and a tear in the eyes of Friederike spurred me on. "Woe betide those," I said, "who use their power over a human heart to destroy the simple pleasures it would naturally enjoy. All the favours, all the attentions in the world cannot compensate for the loss of that happiness which a cruel tyranny has destroyed." My heart was full as I spoke. A recollection of many things which had happened pressed upon my mind and filled my eyes with tears. "We should daily repeat to ourselves," I exclaimed, "that we should not interfere with our friends, unless to leave them in possession of their own joys and increase their happiness by sharing it with them. For when their souls are tormented by a violent passion, or their hearts rent with grief, is it in your power to afford them the slightest consolation? And when the last fatal illness seizes the being whose untimely grave you have prepared, when she lies languid and exhausted before you, her dim eyes raised to heaven, and the damp of death upon her pallid brow, there you stand at her bedside like a condemned criminal, with the bitter feeling that your whole fortune could not save her, and the agonizing thought wrings you that all your efforts are powerless to impart even a moment's strength to the departing soul, or quicken her with a fleeting spark of courage." At these words, the remembrance of a similar scene at which I had been once present fell with full force upon my heart. I buried my face in my handkerchief and hastened from the room, and was only recalled to my recollection by Lotta's voice, who reminded me that it was time to return home. With what tenderness she scolded me on the way for the too eager interest I took in everything. She declared it would ruin me, and that I ought to spare myself. "Yes, my angel, I will do so for your sake." The 6th of July. She is still with her dying friend, and is still the same bright, beautiful creature whose presence softens pain and sheds happiness around, whichever way she turns. She went out yesterday evening with her friend Mariana and her little sister Malchin. I knew this and went to meet them, and we walked together. About an hour and a half later we returned to the town. We stopped at the well I'm so fond of, and which is now 1,000 times dearer to me than ever. Lotta seated herself upon the low wall, and we gathered about her. I looked around and recalled the time when my heart was unoccupied and free. "Sweet well," I said. "Since that time I have no more come to enjoy cool repose by your fresh stream. I have passed you with careless steps and scarcely bestowed a glance upon you." I looked down and observed Malchin coming up the steps with a glass of water. I turned towards Lotta, and I felt all that she meant to me. Malchin at that moment approached with the glass. Mariana wished to take it from her.
No, cried the child, with the sweetest expression. Lotta must drink first.
The affection and simplicity with which this was uttered so charmed me that I sought to express my feelings by lifting up the child and kissing her heartily. She was frightened and began to cry.
You should not have done that, said Lotta.
I felt perplexed.
Come, Malchen, she continued, taking her hand and leading her down the steps again. No harm is done. Wash yourself quickly in the fresh water.
I stood and watched them, and when I saw the little one rubbing her cheeks with her wet hands, in full belief that all the impurities contracted from my ugly beard would be washed off by the miraculous water, and how, though Lotta said, that will do, she continued still to wash with all her might, as though she thought too much were better than too little. I assure you, Wilhelm, I never attended a baptism with greater reverence. And when Lotta came up from the well, I could have prostrated myself as before a prophet who had by sacred rituals taken away the sins of a nation. In the evening I would not resist telling the story to a man who I thought possessed some natural feeling because he was a man of understanding. But what a mistake I made. He maintained it was very wrong of Lotta, that we should not deceive children, that such things occasioned countless mistakes and superstitions from which we were bound to protect the young. It occurred to me then that this very man had had a child baptized only a week before, so I said nothing further, but maintained faith in my own convictions. We should deal with children as God deals with us. We are happiest under the influence of innocent delusions. The 8th of July. What a child is man that he should hunger for a certain look! What a child is man! We had been to Walheim. The ladies were in a carriage, but during our walk I thought I saw in Lotta's dark eyes. I am a fool, but forgive me, you should see them, those eyes. However, to be brief, for my own eyes are weighed down with sleep, you must know, when the ladies stepped into their carriage again, young W. Zellstadt, Oudron and I were standing about the door. They are a merry set of fellows, and they're all laughing and joking together. I sought Lotta's eyes. They wandered from one to the other, but they did not light on me. On me, who stood there motionless and saw nothing but her. My heart bade her a thousand times adieu, but she noticed me not. The carriage drove off, and my eyes filled with tears. I watched it drawing away. Suddenly I saw Lotta's bonnet leaning out of the window, and she turned to look back. Was it at me? My dear friend, I know not. And in this uncertainty I find comfort. Perhaps she turned to look at me, perhaps. Good night. Oh, what a child I am. The 10th of July. You should see how foolish I look in company when her name is mentioned, especially when I'm asked plainly how I like her. How I like her! I detest the phrase. What sort of creature must he be who merely liked Lotta, whose whole heart and senses were not entirely absorbed by her? Like her? Someone asked me lately how I liked Ossian. The 11th of July. Frau M. is very ill. I pray for her recovery because Lotta shares my sufferings. I see her occasionally at my friend's house, and today she has told me the strangest circumstance. Old M. is a covetous, miserly skinflint, who sadly has long troubled and hampered the poor lady, but she has borne her afflictions patiently. A few days ago, when the doctor informed us that her recovery was hopeless, she sent for her husband, Lotta was in the room, and said, "I have something to confess, which after my death may occasion trouble and confusion. I have, until now, conducted your household as frugally and as thriftily as possible, but you must pardon me for having deceived you for 30 years. At the start of our married life, you allowed a small sum for the needs of the kitchen and other household expenses. When our household increased, and our business grew larger, I could not persuade you to increase the weekly allowance in proportion. In short, you know that when our wants were greatest, you required me to supply everything with 7 florins a week. I took the money from you without argument, but made up the weekly deficit from the takings, as nobody would suspect your wife of robbing the till. But I have wasted nothing, and should have been content to meet my Maker without making this confession, but for the knowledge that she, to whom the housekeeping will fall after my death, will be unable to make ends meet, and that you will insist that the allowance made to me, your former wife, was sufficient. I talked with Lotta of the inconceivable manner in which men allow themselves to be blinded, how anyone could possibly avoid suspecting some deception, when only 7 florins were allowed for expenses twice as great. But I have myself known people who believed, without seeming to wonder about it, that their house possessed the prophet's never-failing cruse of oil. The 13th of July. No, I am not deceived. In her dark eyes I read a genuine interest in me and in my fortunes. Yes, I feel it. And I may believe my own heart, which tells me, dare I say it, dare I pronounce the divine words, that she loves me. That she loves me. How the idea exalts me in my own eyes. And as you can understand my feelings, I may say to you how I honour myself since she loves me. Is this presumption, or is it a consciousness of the truth? I do not know a man able to supplant me in the heart of Lotta, and yet when she speaks of her betrothed with so much warmth and affection, I feel like the soldier who has been stripped of his honours and titles and deprived of his sword. The 16th of July. How my heart beats when by accident I touch her finger, or my feet meet hers under the table. I draw back as if from fire, but a secret force impels me forward again, and my senses become disordered. Her innocent, unconscious heart never knows what agony these little intimacies inflict upon me. Sometimes, when we are talking, she lays her hand upon mine, and in the eagerness of conversation comes closer to me, and her balmy breath reaches my lips. When I feel as if lightning had struck me, and that I could sink into the earth, and yet, Wilhelm, if I ever dared, this heaven, this trust, you understand me. No, no, my heart is not so corrupt. It is weak, weak enough. But is not that a form of depravity? She is to me a sacred being. All desire falls silent in her presence. I cannot express my feelings when I am near her. I feel as if my soul beat in every nerve of my body. There is a melody which she plays on the piano with angelic skill. So simple it is, and yet so spiritual. It is her favourite tune, and when she plays the first note, all pain, care, and sorrow disappear from me in a moment. I believe every word that is said of the magic of ancient music. How her simple song enchants me. Sometimes, when I feel like putting a bullet through my head, she sings that tune, and instantly the gloom and madness which hung over me are dispersed, and I breathe freely again. The 18th of July. Wilhelm, how does the world feel to us without love? Like a magic lantern without a light, you have but to put the little lamp into it, and the brightest figures shine on the white wall, and, if it were no more than that, fleeting phantoms, we are yet happy when, like innocent boys, we behold them and are transported by the splendid visions. I've not been able to see Lotta today. I was prevented by company from which I could not disengage myself. What was to be done? I sent my servant to her house, that I might at least see somebody today who would be near her. Oh, the impatience with which I waited for his return, the joy with which I welcomed him. I should certainly have caught him in my arms and kissed him if I'd not been ashamed. It is said that the Bologna stone, when placed in the sun, attracts the rays, and for a time appears luminous in the dark. So was it with me and this servant. The idea that Lotta's eyes had dwelt on his countenance, his cheek, his very apparel, endeared them all inestimably to me, so that at that moment I would not have parted from him for 1,000 crowns. His presence made me so happy. Beware of laughing at me. Can that be a delusion, Wilhelm, which makes us happy? the 19th of July.
"I shall see her today," I exclaim with delight when I rise in the morning, and look out with gladness of heart at the bright, beautiful sun. "I shall see her today."
And then I have no further wish. Everything, everything is included in that one prospect. The 20th of July. I cannot assent to your proposal that I should accompany the envoy to blank. I do not like to subordinate myself to rank, and we all know that he is a disagreeable person. You say my mother wishes me to be employed. I could not help laughing at that.
Am I not sufficiently employed? And is it not in reality the same whether I shell peas or count lentils? The world runs on from one folly to another, and the man who, solely from regard to the opinion of others, and without any wish or necessity of his own, toils after gold, honour, or any other phantom, is no better than a fool.
The 24th of July. You insist so much on my not neglecting my drawing that it would be as well for me to say nothing as to confess how little I have lately done. I never felt happier. I never understood nature better, even down to the smallest stone or blade of grass. And yet I am unable to express myself. My powers of execution are so weak. Everything seems to swim and float before me so that I cannot make a clear, bold outline. But I fancy I should succeed better if I had some clay or wax to model. I shall try, if this state of mind continues much longer, and will take to modelling, if I only need dough for cakes. I have begun Lotta's portrait 3 times, and have as often disgraced myself. This is the more annoying, as I was formerly very happy in taking likenesses. I have since completed a silhouette of her, and must content myself with that.
The 25th of July.
Yes, dear Lotta, I will order and arrange everything. Only give me more commissions, the more the better. One thing, however, I must request. Sprinkle no more sand on the dear notes you send me. Today I raised your letter hastily to my lips, and it set my teeth on edge.
The 26th of July.
I have often determined not to see her so frequently, but who could keep such a resolution? Every day I am exposed to the temptation and promise faithfully that tomorrow I will really stay away. But when tomorrow comes, I find some irresistible reason for seeing her, and before I can account for it, I'm with her again. Either, she said on the previous evening, "You'll be sure to call tomorrow," and who could stay away then? Or she gives me some commission and I find it necessary to take her the answer in person, or the day is fine and I walk to Valheim, and when I am there, it is only 30 minutes further to her. I'm within the charmed atmosphere, and soon find myself at her side. My grandmother used to tell us a story of the magnetic mountain. When any vessels came near it, they were instantly deprived of their ironwork, the nails flew to the mountain, and the unhappy crew perished amidst the disjointed planks.
The 30th of July.
Albert has arrived, and I must take my departure. Were he the best and noblest of men, and I in every respect his inferior, I could not endure to see him in possession of such a perfect being. Possession! Enough, Wilhelm. Her betrothed is here. A fine, worthy fellow whom one cannot help liking. Fortunately, I was not present at their meeting. It would have broken my heart. And he is so considerate. He has not given Lotta one kiss in my presence. Heaven reward him for it. I must love him for the respect with which he treats her. He shows a regard for me, but for this I suspect I'm more indebted to Lotta than to his own fondness for me. Women have a delicate tact in such matters, and it should be so. They cannot always succeed in keeping two rivals on terms with each other, but when they do, they are the only gainers. I cannot help esteeming Albert. The coolness of his temper contrasts strongly with the impetuosity of mine, which I cannot conceal. He has a great deal of feeling and is fully sensible of the treasure he possesses in Lotta. He is free from ill humour, which you know is the fault I detest most. He regards me as a man of sense, and my attachment to Lotta and the interest I take in all that concerns her increase his triumph and his love. I shall not inquire whether he may not at times tease her with some little jealousies, as I know that were I in his place, I should not be entirely free of that demon. But, be that as it may, my joy in being with Lotta is over. Call it folly or blindness, what signifies a name? The thing speaks for itself. Before Albert came, I knew all that I know now. I knew I could make no claim to her, nor did I offer any, that is, as far as it was possible in the presence of so much loveliness, not to yearn for its enjoyment. And now behold me like a silly fellow, staring with astonishment when another comes in and deprives me of my love. I clench my teeth and feel infinite scorn for those who tell me to be resigned, because there is no help for it. Spare me these silly straw men. I ramble through the woods, and when I return to Lotta and find Albert sitting by her side in the summer-house in the garden, I am unable to bear it, behave like a fool, and commit a thousand extravagances. "For heaven's sake," said Lotta today, "let us have no more scenes like those of last night. You terrify me when you act the fool like that." Between you and me, I am always away now when he visits her, and I feel delighted when I find her alone. The 8th of August. Believe me, dear Wilhelm, I did not allude to you when I spoke so severely of those who advise resignation to inevitable fate. I did not think it possible that you might indulge that opinion. But in fact, you are right. I only make one objection. In this world, matters rarely come down to either or. There are so many gradations in conduct and opinion as there are between an aquiline nose and a snub one. You will therefore permit me to concede your entire argument, and yet contrive means to escape the either and the or. Your position is this. I hear you say, either you have hopes of obtaining Lotta, or you have none. Well, in the first case, pursue your course and press on to the fulfilment of your wishes. In the second, be a man and shake off a miserable passion which will consume your energies and destroy you. My dear friend, that is both well said and easier said than done. But would you require a wretched being whose life is slowly wasting under a lingering disease to dispatch himself at once by the stroke of a dagger? Does not the very disorder which consumes his strength deprive him of the courage to free himself of it? You may answer me, if you please, with a similar analogy. Who would not prefer to have his arm amputated rather than endanger his life through doubt and hesitation? But I know not if I am right. And let us leave these comparisons. Enough. There are moments, Wilhelm, when I could rise up and shake it all off, and when, if I only knew where to go, I could fly from this place. The same evening. My diary, which I have for some time neglected, came before me today, and I am amazed to see how consciously I've entangled myself step by step. To have seen my position so clearly, and yet to have acted so like a child. Even still I see the result plainly, and yet have no thought of acting with greater prudence. The 10th of August. If I were not a fool, I could spend the happiest and most delightful life here. So many agreeable circumstances, and of a kind to ensure a worthy man's happiness, are seldom united. Alas, I feel it too sensibly. The heart alone makes our happiness. To be admitted into this most charming family, to be loved by the old father as a son, by the children as a father, and by Lotta. And then the noble Albert, who never disturbs my happiness by any appearance of ill humour, receiving me with the heartiest affection, and loving me, next to Lotta, better than all the world. Wilhelm, you would be delighted to hear us on our rambles, talking about Lotta. Nothing in the world can be more absurd than this relationship, and yet the thought of it often moves me to tears. He tells me sometimes of her excellent mother, how upon her deathbed she had committed her house and children to Lotta, and had given Lotta herself in charge to him, how since that time a new spirit had taken possession of her, how in care and anxiety for their welfare She became a real mother to them, how every moment of her time was devoted to some labour of love on their behalf. And yet her mirth and cheerfulness had never forsaken her. I walk by his side, pluck flowers by the way, arrange them carefully into a bouquet, then fling them into the first stream I pass, and watch them as they float gently away. I forget whether I told you that Albert is to remain here. He has received a government appointment with a very good salary, and I understand he is in high favour at court. I have met few persons so punctual and methodical in business. The 12th of August. Indeed, Albert is the best fellow in the world. I had a strange scene with him yesterday. I went to take leave of him, for I took it into my head to spend a few days in these mountains from where I now write to you. As I was walking up and down his room, my eye fell upon his pistols. "Lend me those pistols," I said, "for my journey." "By all means," he replied, "if you will take the trouble to load them, for they only hang there for show." I took one of them down, and he continued, "Ever since I got into trouble for taking precautions, I want nothing to do with the things." I was curious to hear the story. "I was staying," he said, "some 3 months ago at a friend's house in the country. I had a brace of pistols with me, unloaded, and I slept without any anxiety. One rainy afternoon I was sitting by myself, doing nothing, when it occurred to me, I do not know how, that the house might be attacked, that we might require the pistols, that we might... you know how it is. I gave the pistols to the servant to clean and load. He was playing with the girls and trying to frighten them, when the pistol went off. God knows how, the ramrod was in the barrel, and it went straight through the right hand of one of the girls and shattered the thumb. I had to endure all the fuss and pay for her treatment, so since that time I have kept all my weapons unloaded. But, my dear friend, what is the use of taking precautions? We can never be on our guard against all possible dangers. However, now, you must know I can tolerate all men till they come to however, for it is self-evident that every universal rule must have its exceptions. But he is so exceedingly accurate that if he only fancies he has said a word too hasty, or too general, or only half true, he never ceases to qualify, to modify and extenuate, till at last he appears to have said nothing at all. Upon this occasion Albert was deeply immersed in his subject. I ceased to listen to him and was taken by a foolish whim. With a sudden motion I pointed the mouth of the pistol to my forehead, over the right eye. "What are you doing?" cried Albert, turning back the pistol. "It is not loaded," I said. "Even so, what are you doing?" he answered with impatience. "I cannot comprehend how a man can be so mad as to shoot himself, and the very thought of it shocks me." "But why should anyone," I said, "in speaking of an action, venture to pronounce it mad, or wise, or good, or bad? What do they mean by this? Have you carefully studied the secret motives of our actions? Do you understand? Can you explain the causes which occasion them, and make them inevitable? If you can, you will be less hasty with your judgment." "But you will allow," said Albert, "that some actions are criminal, whatever motives they spring from." I conceded it, and shrugged my shoulders. "But still, my dear Albert," I continued, "there are some exceptions here too. Theft is a crime, but the man who commits it from extreme poverty, with no design but to save his family from starvation, should he be subject to pity or punishment? Who shall throw the first stone at a husband who, in the heat of just resentment, sacrifices his faithless wife and her perfidious seducer, or at the girl who, in an hour of bliss, forgets herself in the impetuous joys of love? Even our laws, cold-blooded pedants though they are, relent in such cases and withhold their punishment." "That is quite another matter," said Albert, "because a man under the influence of violent passion loses all power of reflection, and is regarded as drunk or mad." "Oh, you reasonable people," I replied, smiling, "are always ready to exclaim, 'Passion and madness and intoxication.' You moral men are so calm and so subdued. You abhor the drunken man and detest the madman. You pass by like the priest, and thank God, like the Pharisee, that you are not like one of them. I have been drunk more than once, My passions have always bordered on madness. I am not ashamed to confess it, for I have learnt, by my own experience, that all extraordinary men, who have accomplished great and astonishing acts, have ever been decried by the world as drunken or insane. And in our private life, too, is it not intolerable that no one can undertake a noble or generous deed without someone decrying him as drunk or mad? Shame on you, you wise men! Shame on you, you sober men! More of your extravagant whims, said Albert. You always exaggerate a case, and in this matter you are undoubtedly wrong, for we were speaking of suicide, which you compare with great deeds when it is impossible to regard it as anything but a weakness. It is much easier to die than to bear a life of misery with fortitude. I was on the point of breaking off the conversation, for nothing puts me so completely out of patience as the utterance of a wretched commonplace when I am talking from my inmost heart. However, I composed myself, for I had often heard the same observation with sufficient anger, and I answered him, therefore, with a little warmth. You call this a weakness? Beware of being led astray by appearances. When a nation which has long groaned under the intolerable yoke of a tyrant rises at last and throws off its chains, do you call that weakness? The man who, to rescue his house from the flames, finds his physical strength redoubled, so that he lifts burdens with ease which in a quiet state he could scarcely move. He, who under the rage of an insult, attacks and puts to flight half a dozen of his enemies, are such people to be called weak? My good friend, if resistance is strength, how can the highest degree of resistance be a weakness? Albert looked steadfastly at me and said, Pray forgive me, but I do not see that the examples you have given bear any relation to the question. Very likely, I answered, for I have often been told that my style of illustration borders a little on the absurd. But let us see if we cannot see the matter from another perspective by inquiring what can a man's state of mind be who resolves to free himself from the burden of life, a burden often so pleasant to bear, for we cannot otherwise reason fairly upon the subject. Human nature, I continued, has its limits. It is able to endure a certain degree of joy, sorrow, and pain, but becomes annihilated as soon as this measure is exceeded. The question, therefore, is not whether a man is strong or weak, but whether he is able to endure the measure of his sufferings. The suffering may be moral or physical, and in my opinion, it is just as absurd to call a man a coward who destroys himself as to call a man a coward who dies of a malignant fever. Paradox, all paradox, exclaimed Albert. Not so paradoxical as you imagine, I replied. You will allow that when nature is so severely attacked and her strength so far exhausted that she cannot possibly recover her former condition under any change that may take place, we call this a sickness unto death. Now, my good friend, apply this to the mind. Observe a man in his natural, isolated condition. Consider how ideas work and how impressions fasten on him, till at length a violent passion seizes him, destroying all his powers of calm reflection, and utterly ruining him. It is in vain that a man of sound mind and cool temper understands the condition of such a wretched being. In vain he counsels him. He can no more communicate his own wisdom to him than a healthy man can instil his strength into the invalid by whose bedside he is seated. Albert thought this too general. I reminded him of a girl who had drowned herself a short time previously, and I related her history. She was a good creature who had grown up in the narrow sphere of domestic duties and weekly appointed labour, one who knew no pleasure beyond indulging in a walk on Sundays, arrayed in her best attire, accompanied by her friends, or perhaps joining in the dance now and then at some festival, and chatting away her spare hours with a neighbour, discussing the scandal or the quarrels of the village, trifles sufficient to occupy her heart. At length the warmth of her nature is influenced by certain new and unknown wishes. Inflamed by the flatteries of men, her former pleasures become by degrees insipid, till at length she meets with a youth to whom she is attracted by an indescribable feeling. Upon him she now rests all her hopes. She forgets the world around her. She sees, hears, desires nothing but him and him only. He alone occupies all her thoughts. Uncorrupted by the idle indulgence of an enervating vanity, her affection moving steadily towards its object, she hopes to become his, and to realize, in an everlasting union with him, all that happiness which she sought, all that bliss for which she longed. His repeated promises confirm her hopes. Bold embraces and endearments, which increase the ardour of her desires, master her soul. She floats in a dim, delusive anticipation of her happiness, and her feelings become excited to their utmost tension. She stretches out her arms finally to embrace the object of all her wishes, and her beloved leaves her. Stunned and bewildered, she stands upon a precipice. All is darkness around her. No prospect, no hope, no consolation. Forsaken by him in whom her very existence was centred. She sees nothing of the wide world before her, thinks nothing of the many individuals who might supply the void in her heart. She feels herself deserted, abandoned by the world, and blinded and impelled by the agony which wrings her soul. She jumps into the abyss to end her sufferings in the broad embrace of death. See here, Albert, the history of thousands, and tell me, is not this a case of physical infirmity? Nature has no way to escape from the labyrinth. Her powers are exhausted. She can contend no longer, and the poor soul must die. Shame upon him who can look on calmly and exclaim, "The foolish girl! She should have waited. She should have allowed time to do its work. Her despair would have lessened, and she would have found another lover to comfort her." One might as well say, "The fool, to die of a fever. Why did he not wait till his strength was restored, till his blood became calm? All would have been well then, and he would be alive today." Albert, who could not see the justice of the comparison, offered some further objections, and amongst others, urged that I had taken the case of a mere ignorant girl. But how any man of sense, of larger views and experience, could be excused, he was unable to comprehend. "My friend," I exclaimed, "man is but man, and whatever be the extent of his powers of reason, they are of little avail when passion rages within, and he feels himself confined by the narrow limits of nature. It were better then, but we will talk of this some other time," I said, and picked up my hat. Alas, my heart was full, and we parted without having understood each other. How rarely in this world do men understand each other. The 15th of August. There can be no doubt that in this world nothing is so indispensable as love. I observed that Lotta could not lose me without a pang, and even the children have but one wish, that is, that I should visit them again tomorrow. I went this afternoon to tune Lotta's piano, but I could not do it, for the little ones insisted on my telling them a story, and Lotta herself urged me to satisfy them. I cut the bread for their supper, and they are now as fully contented with me as with Lotta, and I told them my very best tale of the princess who was waited upon by Hans. I learn a great deal by doing this, and I am quite surprised at the impression my stories create. If I sometimes invent an incident which I forget upon the next narration, they remind me at once that the story was different before, so that I now endeavour to relate with exactness the same tale in the same sing-song tone, which never changes. I find by this how much an author injures his works by altering them, even though they be improved in a poetical point of view. The first impression is readily received. We are so constituted that we believe the most incredible things, and once they are engraved upon the memory, woe betide anyone who would endeavour to efface them. The 18th of August. Does it have to be the case that the source of our happiness must also be the fountain of our misery? The full and ardent sentiment which animated my heart with the love of nature, overwhelming me with a torrent of delight, and which brought all paradise before me, has now become an insupportable torment, a demon which perpetually pursues and harasses me. When, in bygone days, I gazed from these rocks upon yonder mountains across the river, and upon the green fertile valley before me, and saw all nature budding and bursting around, the hills clothed from foot to peak with tall, thick forest trees, the valleys in all their varied windings, shaded with the loveliest woods, and the soft river gliding along amongst the lisping reeds, mirroring the beautiful clouds which the soft evening breeze wafted across the sky. When I heard the groves about me, melodious with the music of birds, and saw the million swarms of insects dancing in the last golden beams of the sun, whose setting rays awoke the humming beetles from their grassy beds, whilst the subdued tumult around directed my attention to the ground, and I there observed the arid rock compelled to yield nutriment to the dry moss, whilst the heath flourished upon the barren sands below me. All this displayed to me the inner warmth which animates all nature, and filled and glowed within my heart. I felt myself exalted by this overflowing fullness to the perception of the Godhead, and the glorious forms of an infinite universe became visible to my soul. Stupendous mountains encompassed me, abysses yawned at my feet, and cataracts fell headlong down before me, impetuous rivers rolled through the plain, and rocks and mountains resounded from afar. In the depths of the earth I saw innumerable powers in motion, and multiplying to infinity, whilst upon its surface, and beneath the heavens, there teemed 10,000 varieties of living creatures. Everything around is alive with an infinite number of forms, while mankind fly for security to their little houses, from the shelter of which they rule in their imaginations over the wide extended universe. Poor fools, in whose petty estimation all things are little. From the unscalable mountains, across the desert which no mortal foot has trod, far as the confines of the unknown ocean, breathes the spirit of the eternal Creator, and every atom to which he has given existence finds favour in his sight. Ah, how often at that time has the flight of a bird, soaring above my head, inspired me with the desire of being transported to the shores of the immeasurable waters, there to drink the pleasures of life from the foaming goblet of the infinite, and to partake, if but for a moment even, with the confined powers of my soul, the beatitude of that Creator who accomplishes all things in himself and through himself. Brother, the bare recollection of those hours still consoles me. Even this effort to recall those ineffable sensations and give them utterance exalts my soul above itself and makes me doubly feel the intensity of my present anguish. It is as if a curtain had been drawn from before my eyes, and instead of prospects of eternal life, the abyss of an ever-open grave yawned before me. Can we say of anything that it exists when all passes away? When time, with the speed of a storm, carries all things onward, and our transitory existence, hurried along by the torrent, is either swallowed up by the waves or dashed against the rocks. There is not a moment but praise upon you, and upon all around you, not a moment in which you do not yourself become a destroyer. The most innocent walk deprives of life thousands of poor insects. One step destroys the fabric of the industrious ant and converts a little world into chaos. No, it is not the great and rare disasters of the world, the floods which sweep away whole villages, the earthquakes which swallow up our towns that affect me. My heart is wasted by the thought of that devouring force which lies concealed in every part of universal nature. Nature has formed nothing that does not consume itself and every object near it, so that surrounded by earth and air and all the active powers, I wander on my way with aching heart, and the universe is to me a fearful monster, forever devouring its own offspring. The 21st of August. In vain do I stretch out my arms towards her when I awaken in the morning from my weary slumbers. In vain do I seek for her at night in my bed, when some innocent dream has happily deceived me and placed her near me on the grass, when I have seized her hand and covered it with countless kisses, and when I feel for her in the half-confusion of sleep, with the happy sense that she is near, tears flow from my oppressed heart, and bereft of all comfort, I weep over my future woes. The 22nd of August. What a misfortune! Wilhelm, my active spirits have degenerated into contented indolence. I cannot be idle, and yet I am unable to set to work. I cannot think, I have no longer any feeling for the beauties of nature, and books are distasteful to me. Once we give ourselves up, we are totally lost. I swear at times I wish I were a day labourer, that awakening in the morning I might have but one prospect, one pursuit, one hope for the day which has dawned. I often envy Albert when I see him buried in a heap of papers and files, and I fancy I should be happy were I in his place. Often impressed with this feeling, I've been on the point of writing to you and to the minister for the post at the embassy, which you think I might obtain. I believe I might procure it. The minister has long shown a regard for me, and has frequently urged me to seek employment, and for perhaps an hour I agree it might be a good idea. Now and then the fable of the horse recurs to me. Weary of freedom, he suffered himself to be saddled and bridled, and was ridden to death for his pains. I know not what I should do, for is not this anxiety for change the consequence of that restless spirit which would pursue me equally in every situation of life? The 28th of August. If my sickness would admit of any cure, it would certainly be cured amongst these people. Today is my birthday, and early in the morning I received a little parcel from Albert. Upon opening it, I found one of the pale red ribbons which Lotta wore in her dress the first time I saw her, and which I had several times asked her to give me. With it were two volumes in duodecimo of Wettstein's Homer, a book I had often wished for, to save me the inconvenience of hauling about the large Ernesti edition with me upon my walks. You see how they anticipate my wishes, how well they understand all those little attentions of friendship, so superior to those dazzling, costly presents which serve the giver's vanity and are humiliating to the recipient. I kissed the ribbon a thousand times, and in every breath inhaled the remembrance of those happy and irrevocable days which filled me with the keenest joy. Such, Wilhelm, is our fate. I do not complain. The blossom of life is but a vision. How much of it eats away and leaves no trace behind, how little of it yields any fruit, and the fruit itself, how rarely does it ripen. And yet there is fruit enough. And is it not strange, my friend, that we should suffer the little that does really ripen, to rot, decay, and perish unenjoyed? Farewell. This is a glorious summer. I often climb into the trees in Lotta's orchard and shake down the pears that hang on the highest branches with a long pole. She stands below and catches them as they fall. The 30th of August. Fool, unhappy being that you are, why do you deceive yourself? What is to come of all this wild, aimless, endless passion? I cannot pray except to her. My imagination sees nothing but her. All surrounding objects are of no account except as they relate to her. In this dreamy state I enjoy many happy hours, till at length I feel compelled to tear myself away from her. Ah, Wilhelm, what things and often my heart drives me to! When I have spent several hours in her company, till I feel completely absorbed by her figure, her grace, the divine expression of her thoughts, my mind becomes gradually excited to the highest excess, my sight grows dim, my hearing confused, my breathing oppressed as if by the hand of a murderer, and my beating heart seeks to obtain relief for my aching senses. I am sometimes unconscious whether I really exist. If in such moments I find no sympathy, and Charlotta does not allow me to enjoy the melancholy consolation of bathing her hand with my tears, I feel compelled to tear myself from her. When I either wander through the country, climb some precipitous cliff, or force a path through the trackless thicket, where I am lacerated and torn by thorns and briars, and then I find relief. Sometimes I lie stretched on the ground, overcome with fatigue and thirst. Sometimes, late in the night, when the moon shines above me, I recline against an aged tree in some lonely wood, to rest my weary limbs. When exhausted and worn, I sleep till break of day. Oh, Wilhelm,